Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location. Today, we're going to talk about the role of food in either causing wellness or disease, always from mainstream institutions using peer-reviewed literature. And why do I give you all this verification? Because we're a program of record. People know the degree of scholarship that goes into each and every one of the research papers, the reports that we give. So you can trust this information. Verify all that you want, and you'll see that we're on point. Sometimes 5 or 10 years ahead of the mainstream media that's often pressured by special interest groups and advertisers not to tell you the full truth. We will. Then we're going to play another in our ongoing series of challenges to how we are perceiving our reality today. This is a woman. She is a very distinguished professor at the University of Ottawa, and she believes that there is just too much politics in how men and women are viewed and being put against each other. And so she challenges it. She's challenging the third wave feminist notions. Good for her, just like Professor Camille Paglia has challenged the second wave, and she was a part of the second wave, but rejected by most feminists. Well, go back and look at who was right 30, 40 years on. She was. And I'll bet that this woman will have a lot to say that will make us think differently. Agree or disagree, in part or whole, but give people who are different or controversial, a forum. At least we know what they're thinking. Then I have a guest also today, and my guest is going to be talking about the scientific evidence to support the underlying principles of the paranormal and why this will be a part of the new frontier of science and human potential. He is Dr. Dean Radin, and he is chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and a distinguished professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And he's been around for 40 years looking at frontiers of consciousness, including psi or unique phenomena. He also held appointments at AT&T Bell Labs, Princeton University and University of Edinburgh, and Stanford University Research Institute. So he's a heavyweight, but something interesting to discuss, and that'll be our guest. That's our program. We have a lot to share. We always begin with the latest on health. This is from Johns Hopkins University, and it's about eating processed meat threatens your state of mind, according to scientific research. Meaning this, that psychiatric disorders are often made worse by an improper diet. Now, new research from Johns Hopkins has found that cured and processed meat, that's bologna, that's salami, that's what you get on pizzas, especially in persons who already have any disorder, it exacerbates it. The study involved more than 1,000 persons, both with and without psychiatric diagnosis, and the research looked at their diets and found that hot dogs, salami, jerky, processed meats containing nitrates were prone to an abnormally elevated mood state, the manic state. And manic, if you're not familiar with it, is characterized by unfounded euphoria or hyperactivity or persistent insomnia. Now, the nitrates in processed meat could be a cause of these problems. And this was published in the recent issue of Molecular Psychiatry. So once again, you're not going to have this problem if you're looking at a healthy plant-based diet. From the National Health Service in Scotland, which is equivalent to our National Institute of Health in America, doctors in Scotland are now prescribing nature to their patients. That's correct. In an age of technology and constant immersion in the digital sphere, a new initiative in Shetland, Scotland, is encouraging individuals suffering from chronic illness to spend more time in nature. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds has teamed up with the National Health Service to promote nature prescriptions, and doctors can now officially prescribe nature to their patients. Quote, from their official statement, from reducing cardiovascular disease, hypertension, stress levels, rates of aggression, and obesity, it can be used when treating type 2 diabetes or depression or when recovering from operations, and has been proven over and over again to provide relief from anxiety. Plus, it's free and easily accessible to all. It makes complete sense to work with the medical profession to connect people with nature. Now, they're not alone. I found a study from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that's our highest and most respected scientific body in America, who found, quote, people who walked for 90 minutes in a natural area, as opposed to participants who walked in a high-traffic urban setting, showed decreased activity in a region of the brain associated with key factors in depression, end quote. So quite simply, the takeaway message is, reconnect people with the outdoors. And that is finally, officially accepted as part of the medical paradigm in Scotland. Wow. How far ahead are they over the entirety of the medical industrial complex in the United States? From Zurich, Switzerland, comes a study on the effects of a high-fat diet, and that's what Americans consume, and they say the adverse effects are passed on for three generations. You're talking about 75 years. Wow. A high-fat diet in this study especially increased insulin resistance and addictive-like behaviors for three generations, and this was published in Translational Psychiatry. Now, this goes back to what I've been sharing for a long time, and that is called EPA, meaning larger genetics, how the environment we're in and the people in that environment, our family, friends, teachers, peers, can impact our well-being and actually alter the outcome of our DNA, our genomes, our cells. So I'll give you an example. Let's say that you want to be a good parent and you do your best, but your mother wanted to be a good parent to you. But let's say her mother or your grandmother was not a good parent. Maybe was very volatile emotionally. Didn't speak, but rather yelled or screamed. Didn't guide softly, but admonished harshly. The epigenetic programming that your mother experienced from her mother is now locked into her genes, and that will impact your genes as well. So negative behavior or positive behavior, either one, can go back several generations. And that's why you can't always understand so easily why someone is acting out or not behaving or not adapting to the environment they're in. You're not going back far enough. From the University of Duisburg in Germany and the Australian Research Center, they found that if you suffer from chronic neck pain, and millions do, cupping, cup, C-U-P-P-I-N-G, cupping, it's an ancient form of alternative medicine. Now, chronic neck pain is a public health concern that does not have a lot of known cures. And recent studies, however, suggest that cupping massage can be effective in easing neck pain and reducing the incidence and severity of discomfort and resulting in an improved quality of life for sufferers. In one study with over 50 patients who were randomly assigned to either a cupping group or a wait list, those in the treatment group went through five sessions of cupping massage on a twice-weekly basis, and the patients in the control group didn't. And the results were substantial. Reduction of pain, discomfort, greater range of motion, quality of life was improved without any adverse results. So let's just say, Gary, I don't know what cupping is. I've never heard of it. Well, cupping is an ancient Chinese therapy based upon the belief that certain health problems are caused by stagnant blood and poor energy flow through your body. So in order to fix or prevent such issues, the practitioner applies cups, usually made of glass or silicone, to the skin. And these cups create a vacuum by suctioning out air. And while this is happening, you will feel a tight sensation in the area where the cups are placed. And the sensation generally is soothing and relaxing. And cups may be moved around or left in place. And depending upon your comfort level and your practitioner's assessment of the problem, these cups create a pressure that sucks skin inward, drawing blood to the affected areas and increasing your overall blood flow. Now, that's a scientific fact. So this increased blood flow is believed to relieve muscle tension and improve circulation and reduce inflammation. And the treatment causes the skin to temporarily turn red or blue or purple, particularly in parts where an injury or energetic blockage is present. And my experience is that people might have slight bruising from this procedure, and I always suggest if you get this procedure, always take quercetin, 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams throughout the day, and quercetin helps heal up bruising anywhere on the body very quickly. Vitamin C can also help as well, and it's non-toxic. There's also a new study from the University of Zurich, again, which is in Switzerland, where there's a link between your gut bacteria, what is called the flora, and multiple sclerosis. Now, let's back it up a little bit. Multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease in which the body's own immune system attacks and damages the protective coating around the nerve cells. And that coating is made up of myelin, M-Y-E-L-I-N. That's a biological membrane of protein and fatty substances, which is why research efforts to find the disease's target antigen, that's the attacking agent, have so far focused on myelin's membrane's components. Well, new findings made by the research group of Miera Sosperda and Roland Martin of the University of Zurich's Clinical Research Priority Program, multiple sclerosis, now suggest that it's worth broadening the research perspective, and in the process of doing so, they looked at bacteria. By the way, the results were published in the peer-reviewed journal Science Translational Medicine. And the scientists report that T cells, that's your immune cells responsible for pathological processes, react to a protein called GTP, fucose synthesis. And this enzyme is formed in human cells as well as in bacteria, frequently found in the gastrointestinal flora of patients suffering from multiple sclerosis. So by knowing that the gut in your intestine can impact other diseases in the body, the key here is create a healthy bacteria, you have a healthier gut, you're less susceptible to these diseases. And it also helps your immune system. And that way, you're not constantly producing pathological autoreactive immune cells. So, clean food, clean gut. Bad, dirty food, sugar, meat, alcohol, processed carbohydrates, saturated fats, unhealthy bacteria. Therefore, far more susceptible. From the University of Otago, which is in New Zealand, they found that vitamin C levels reduce the risk of cognitive impairment and poor metabolic function. Well, there you have all your brain conditions of memory and awareness, but you also have diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, all connected with metabolic function. Now, according to the CDC, 2 out of 3 adults in the United States are overweight or obese, and a staggering 100 million Americans have diabetes or prediabetes. In addition, up to 20% of Americans over the age of 65 suffer from mild cognitive impairment. Mind you, mild cognitive means it's slight, but noticeable decline in memory and thinking skills. And although a variety of factors contribute to it, it's not a single factor. One of the things that are not looked at and now have been by this study is vitamin C deficiency. And they're saying that vitamin C deficiency is the root cause of many of these problems. In fact, some scientists, such as medical researchers and in the field who work with vitamin C, state that the population exists in a chronic state of vitamin C shortage because it's just not in any of the foods the average American eats. Do you think that the average person in America gets up in the morning and squeezes organic juice like orange juice? No, they don't. And when they do have orange juice, it's generally the sterilized, pasteurized, and homogenized vitamin C less juice that people drink out of jars. So the takeaway message is get enough vitamin C in your body, and that will help you with cognition, inflammation, and a better metabolic function. Also, the final study I'll mention here is that low copper levels are linked to fatter, fatty cells. This is from Johns Hopkins University. And in studies on mouse cells, Johns Hopkins researchers found that the low levels of cellular copper appear to make fat cells fatter by altering how cells process their main metabolic fuels, such as fat and sugar. And the discovery, they say, adds to evidence that copper homeostasis could be one day a therapeutic target for metabolic disorders, including obesity. Hello, holistic doctors have been using copper at about 2 milligrams, just 2 milligrams, to help balance people in their copper needs. And they've been doing that for the last 40 years. But I'm glad to see that this group caught up. One final thing from the University of Bordeaux in France and Laval University in Quebec, published in the Journal of Gerontology, Biological and Medical Sciences, the polyphenol, there's your grapes and strawberries and blueberries and blackberries. That blueberries and grapes in particular were found to reduce cognitive decline. Quite simply, you're going to have a better brain and therefore better cognition if you're having these flavonoids. And the flavonoids you're getting mainly from berries. So the more berries, the better your brain. And also, viruses in your brain might also bug your bowels. That's Washington University. While studying viruses best known for infecting the brain, researchers stumbled upon clues to a conundrum involving a completely different part of the anatomy, the bowel. What they learned might explain why some people get digestive woes seemingly out of the blue. Viruses such as the West Nile and Zika that target the nervous system in the brain and spinal cord can also kill neurons in the gut and disrupting bowel movement and causing intestinal blockages. I'll get into that on an upcoming program in greater depth. It just means, once again, keep your bowels fed healthy probiotics, prebiotics, fibers from a healthy plant-based diet. We are 18 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going over and hear what one professor has to say specifically about something that is rarely discussed, and that is, have we weaponized this whole idea that men are responsible for all the problems of the world? Every woman must be believed, no matter how stupid that idea is. It's all politics. None of it is reason. None of it is rational. None of it is true. We have to look at things differently than from political and ideological frames of reference. And that's what she's doing. So you can agree or disagree with her. That's your choice. But at least you're gonna learn some things. And she's extremely articulate. We invited her on the show. I got an interesting response from her yesterday, and where she says, she would love to do it, but she's not that good at public speaking, and she's into teaching right now, and that's her focus. But once she gets through the teaching, hopefully in the near future, she will be a guest, and then we can hear from her directly. And her name is Professor Janice, J-A-N-I-C-E, Fiammingo, F-I-A-M-E-N-G-O. She's a professor of English at the University of Ottawa, and she's a very skilled lecturer, and I think you'll find her engaging, whether you agree or disagree. We provide forms, and you provide your either acceptance or rejection of any one of them. Back in a moment with her. Please stay with us.
I'm your boogeyman. That's what I am. I'm here to do whatever I can. Be it early morning, late afternoon.
Evidence suggests that there are more genius level men than women in some of the most notable areas of human endeavor. Do we have to pretend not to know this? And might our society's pretense about female intellectual equality hold a clue to feminist rage? That's my subject on today's Fiammingo File. I'm Janice Fiammingo of the University of Ottawa. Recently, I was re-watching a video conversation on TV Ontario's program, The Agenda. It featured University of Toronto psychologist Jordan Peterson, now well known to many of us, and a University of Tel Aviv feminist neuroscientist named Daphna Joel, who claims her research shows that male and female brains are indistinguishable. The feminist professor made two notable claims during the program that represent the standard feminist position on sex differences. The first is that scientific research into innate male-female differences should be seen as, quote, politically illegitimate, in her words. And the second is that even if we had proof of innate cognitive and behavioral sex differences, that wouldn't make any helpful difference to social policy. Her example for this position was that proof of a greater male tendency to aggression shouldn't make any difference to how we raise young men, our practice of teaching young men not to be aggressive. Now, her assumption here is that if we believe that something is biologically determined, then we will see it as unalterable and, in fact, good. But really, we've believed for centuries that men are, in general, more aggressive than women, and we have not only taught cultural values such as self-control and indeed chivalry to men, but have also sought to harness male aggression in socially productive ways. So knowledge and wisdom don't always go together, of course, but there is certainly no evidence that suppression of knowledge leads to wisdom. And it is deplorable to see a scientist declaring certain research out of bounds altogether. But this is now the standard SJW position, that we must suppress the search for knowledge in the name of equality. According to Professor Daphna Joel, research into biological sex differences will always be used for political ends to justify misogyny and discrimination against women and special privileges for men. Like so many feminist assertions that have been generally accepted, this claim's unfalsifiability has not so far weakened its persuasiveness. In other words, it is neither provable nor disprovable, but it feels right, even though it requires us to assume what is patently unlikely, that the majority of non-feminist researchers, both male and female, have some kind of vested interest in justifying inequality. And even though the claim skirts the obvious fact that feminist research will definitely be used for political ends, since that is its declared purpose, to promote feminist conceptions of what society owes women and to make those the foundation of often costly and far-reaching social policies. So why should we be more inclined to trust a feminist researcher with a declared ideological bias than to trust a non-feminist researcher with no declared bias and a dedication to following evidence wherever it leads? Daphna Joel's research has in fact been widely, and as far as I could discover, mostly uncritically reported in major magazines and newspapers across the Western world. Using MRI brain images, she and her team at Tel Aviv University have, it is claimed, found no significant differences between male and female brains. According to a late 2015 report in the magazine Science, the majority of male and female brains studied by Joel's researchers were a mosaic of male and female structures. Here's the key quotation from the report. Quote, depending on whether the researchers looked at gray matter, white matter, or the diffusion tensor imaging data, between 23% and 53% of brains contained a mix of regions that fell on the male end and female end of the spectrum. Very few of the brains, between 0% and 8%, contained all male or all female structures. End quote. I make no claim to being capable of evaluating this finding, but I can say that the manner in which the information is presented seems to me at best unhelpful and at worst deliberately misleading. For one, it is not at all clear whether brain structure is the sole or primary determinant of male-female cognitive difference. For another, the percentages cited in the report do not clearly make the case we're told they make. To say that depending on what variable is studied, 23% to 53% of brains contained a mix of male and female regions doesn't prove that male and female brains are indistinguishable. The numbers reveal that depending on the variable, a large majority of brains, as high as 77%, if I'm doing the math correctly, did not contain much of a mix. Tell me, am I wrong? It is stated that between 0 and 8% of brains contained all male or female structures, but I would like to know what percentage contained a preponderance of male or female structures. Why are we not told that? It would certainly seem to make logical sense that male and female brains would share many structural features, since many of the things men and women have to do in life are the same. But it also makes sense that there would be some significant general differences given our sexual differences. The research is presented in such a manner to prevent readers from thinking well about the reported findings. And even more than this, I'm struck by the totalizing tenor of Professor Joel's own conclusions about her findings. Usually, scientists worthy of the name are very conservative in the conclusions they're willing to draw from their research. They are scrupulous about not concluding more than the findings will strictly authorize. But not so Daphna Joel. She essentially declares that as a result of her work, research into sex differences in the brain is all but over. She actually has the temerity to say that from now on, this is what she says, quote, researchers studying the brain may not need to compare males and females when analyzing their data. For another, she says, the extreme variability of human brains undermines the justifications for single-sex education based on innate differences between males and females, and perhaps even undermines our definitions of gender as a social category, end quote. That was all a quotation from Professor Daphna Joel. I've never before heard of a serious scientist declaring that her research results are so conclusive that other researchers should simply stop pursuing related research. This goes beyond confidence well into totalitarian arrogance. And unfortunately, it's not surprising that the same professor who deplored the use of scientific research for, quote, political ends, immediately moved to give her research a political application, in this case to discredit single-sex schools despite their beneficial impacts, and to support the feminist claim that gender is a social construct. Such statements certainly make me wonder whether Daphna Joel shouldn't be regarded as an ideologue rather than a real scientist, though you wouldn't know that from the credulous manner in which her pronouncements have been generally received. And you certainly wouldn't know of the mountain of evidence documenting the cognitive and behavioral differences between male and female, some of it pretty difficult to refute through the social constructionist lens, such as that research cited by Professor Jordan Peterson in the Agenda program that I mentioned at the beginning of the video. He refers to a study by Simon Baron Cohen showing fairly marked sex differences in one-day-old male and female infants. The fact that Joel never acknowledges this work seems a remarkably unscientific position. For a very different approach to sex distinctions in cognition, consider the work of Doreen Kimura, who was a PhD in psychobiology and a professor at the University of Western Ontario, and whose book Sex and Cognition represents a lifetime's worth of objective research into the neural and hormonal bases of behavioral and cognitive sex differences. Unlike Professor Joel, whose ideological agenda is clear, Professor Kimura pursued her research to increase human knowledge, not because she began with a cherished theory that she was determined to support. Through a multitude of controlled tests in problem-solving, memory, and other cognitive abilities, Kimura's research found that on average, men outperformed women in a variety of spatial tasks, especially involving identifying objects in altered orientations. Men also excelled at tests of mathematical reasoning. This is worth emphasizing. Men excelled at tests of mathematical reasoning, with the differences between the sexes most remarkable when it comes to the most brilliant mathematicians. Women, in contrast, were generally better able to recall the spatial layout of an array of objects, to scan arrays quickly to find matching objects, and to recall words. Kimura found that such sex differences, which occur across cultures, usually begin at an early age, before puberty, and last a lifetime. Unlike Tel Aviv's university's Daphna Joel, Western University's Doreen Kimura was never interested in dictating what kind of research other scientists should pursue or how society at large could make use of scientific findings. She co-founded the Society for Academic Freedom and Scholarship to protect the freedom of scholars to pursue the research that most interested them. She was one of the few brave souls to defend Professor Larry Summers of Harvard University when he got himself into trouble after speculating about the reason more men than women excel at very high-level mathematics. Kimura was interested in scientific fact, not politics. In a report on her research, she was quoted as regretting the insistence on equality of outcome in STEM fields. This is what she said. Quote, engaging in coercive social engineering to balance the sex ratios may actually be the worst kind of discrimination, she claimed. It also serves, she went on to say, to entice some people into fields they will neither excel in nor enjoy, end quote. This last point about enticing women into fields they won't excel in or enjoy got me thinking about the flip side to feminist Professor Joel's insistence that research into sex differences is illegitimate, even dangerous. Maybe not pursuing sex differences is more dangerous. Now, I can understand Joel's concern to some small extent. If society accepts what seems to be the case, that there are more genius-level men than women in the field of mathematics, it's possible that there would be some discrimination against women wishing to study mathematics or to enter mathematics-related fields, such as engineering and physics. This is possible, as I say, but highly unlikely in our current gynocentric climate. After all, no one claims that there are no female math geniuses, only that there are fewer than male math geniuses. A society that values individual excellence will naturally honor and promote true math ability in women. Women should and will have the right, if they are intellectually equipped, to pursue mathematics-related work. The risk of discriminating against women in math seems vastly outweighed by the far more dangerous risks for women, men, and society overall of insisting on women's equal intellectual ability and thus of pushing women into such positions in the name of gender justice. I've touched on this problem in some previous videos, but I just recently came across an article in a publication called Academic Questions that gave this problem a name and an interesting backstory. The article is called, quote, Snowflake Jacobins, Black Rage on Campus. In it, the author Russell Neely provided an explanation for the outburst of angry accusations and radical demands by black students on American college campuses over the past couple of years. Neely refers to, quote, a phenomenon long known to historians and social scientists that might be termed the Tocqueville effect, after its first extensive description by Alexis de Tocqueville in his book The Old Regime and the French Revolution. De Tocqueville was an aristocratic French intellectual born in 1805, fascinated by democratic government and best known for his book Democracy in America. In the later work cited by Neely, which was published in 1856, Tocqueville explained the conditions that cause people to engage in violent revolution, conditions which are not always linked to objectively real oppression. Instead, he found, quote, extreme anger and hostility are often the result of a, quote, revolution of rising expectations in which certain groups come to entertain exaggerated hopes of a better future, hopes that the actual conditions of life inevitably disappoint, end quote. So such unfulfilled expectations lead to frustration, bitterness, and outrage, which in turn lead to protests, demands for change, and even, as in some cases, riots and violence. Leaving aside the question of whether the theory does indeed apply to black students on campus, we can see that feminists, too, have been shaped by a, quote, revolution of rising expectations, end quote. The fact is that the position of women in Western societies is very good by nearly any measure except the feminist measure. The feminist dream and confident prediction was that once barriers to women's participation were removed, women would flourish in intellectually demanding fields such as high-level maths. But women haven't flourished, at least not in the numbers feminists confidently expected. If we look at Nobel Prizes awarded since 1986, the year affirmative action hiring became federal law in Canada. That's why I chose it, though of course it doesn't apply to women in other countries. If we look at Nobel Prizes, we find that in the science categories, physics, chemistry, and physiology or medicine, women have won only 10 out of the 220 Nobel Prizes. That's about 4.5% of the total number of awards. To say that this is a disappointing outcome would be an understatement. It's not much different from women's performance in the bad old days of so-called patriarchal discrimination. In fact, in the years 1900 to 1920, women achieved 2 out of the 60 prizes in the same categories, about 3.3% of the prizes. So rising expectations among feminists have met the stubborn reality of female underperformance. If you're a feminist and you've accepted feminist claims that all of gender is a social construct and that assertions about cognitive difference are male supremacist fantasies only, then of course you're going to cry foul. You're going to believe that something's holding women back even though nothing is. Thus, feminists are forced to look for ever more subtle but supposedly powerful and omnipresent reasons why women are not performing equally to men. Sexism, sexism, and more sexism. And feminists use claims of sexism to justify yet more demands for special accommodations and artificial advantages. We have seen a plethora of recent articles claiming that science itself is sexist, that women's perspectives are necessary to save science, and that gender bias continues to bar women from fulfilling their potential. It's always the same mantra. More needs to be done for women. These predictable, formulaic, paper-thin complaints would be embarrassing and sad if they were not so socially destructive. A perfect, vicious circle with no end in sight, whereby talented male scientists are barred from the enormously important and beneficial work they should be doing, and less talented women are shoehorned into positions for which they are not well-suited, with a corresponding likelihood that they will, for a combination of reasons, feel resentment, anger, and a determination to bend the the discipline to suit their needs rather than the requirements of science itself, and all because we are wedded to the false idea that gender justice can only be said to have been achieved when women occupy at least 50% of the most prestigious academic, political, and business positions, whether they're the best for the job or not. Maybe it's true that even 50 years after all the real barriers fell, we still don't know what women are capable of in these traditionally male-dominated fields. But it's a certainty that pretending we do know and mobilizing against so-called politically illegitimate research and mandating female numbers in STEM will never produce a rational, healthy, or just society.
Okay, that's her perspective, and I believe we should air these perspectives. Whether we agree or disagree, at least we're seeing what other people are thinking, and it may jog us into more critical thinking as well. From my own view, before we go to our guests, I just want to say that I looked at that science, and I've seen in preparation for a major documentary I produced called Mind Power, the differences in men and women's brains, and where we would like to justify that all brains are the same, they're equal. Our perception, our innate masculinity or femininity are unique and different. And not to recognize that when there are thousands of scientific papers published on this is ridiculous. And to say that we shouldn't have to do any more research because the evidence is in, because one person and their bias in their own presentation and incompleteness say, don't look any further, we have the answer. There's a big difference between people having the opportunity, which people do, to take any subject you want. When you're taking a PhD, you can take it in any course you want. Now, there is where a lot of the science shows that men have a proclivity to take certain courses, and women also have a proclivity to take certain courses. That does not mean that there is injustice or prejudice or segregation. The laws don't allow that. And anyone attempting that today would be sued immediately and shamed completely. So when a person has a chance and an opportunity to do whatever they want, take anything they want, study anything they want, go into any field they want, and we say that it must be equal, and if it's not equal, then there's something wrong. Then we're suggesting that men and women are equal. They have the same desires, the same dreams, the same fantasies, the same perceptions of reality. That's simply not true. And it's an embarrassment at this time in our lives that we have people who are so pronounced and diligent in maintaining this fallacy. I don't have time today to open up for calls, but I will on our next program. We want to go to our guest standing by, Dr. Dean Radin. Nice to have you with us today, Dean.
Thanks for inviting me.
I gave your introduction earlier on in the program, and the fact that that one of your most recent publications, Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom and Modern Science and a Guide to the Power of the Universe, has received some remarkable endorsements. I saw two Nobel laureates in science endorsing it. Mm-hmm. And so good for you, and I wish you well on this.
Thank you.
What historians call magic today, when they look back at religious history, has largely become science today. Astrology led to astronomy. Alchemy morphed into chemistry and even medical practice. Mental disciplines behind magic carried on into modern depth psychology, such as the work of Carl Jung. And since I've devoted my life, my entire life, to the health and medical fields, I realize that it is common for people to be healed by scientific principles that are not completely accepted nor even understood by the dominant medical paradigm. But I feel we need to make a distinction between the word magic being used in the postmodern scientific sense as compared to its broader popular use that is more often than not associated with a specific type of religious-oriented practice. And your interest is to look at what underlies magic as being profoundly scientific, and it should be further explored rather than shunned because it is a part of our human potential. In fact, you argue that the science behind magic may be the next frontier in scientific exploration, especially with respect to research into consciousness. So please, take your time, the forum is yours, and put forth the case that there is a modern scientific basis for the reality of magic.
Okay, that was a very good introduction. First of all, I need to say what I mean by magic. I mean that by analogy, magic is to the esoteric worldview as today's technology is to the scientific worldview. In other words, a worldview is our perspective on what we think reality is like. In the modern educated world, it's the scientific worldview, which is predicated on the idea that everything is made out of matter and energy, including the mind. So that's been a very successful set of assumptions, which gives us all kinds of wonderful technologies. But every worldview always contains blinders. So in this case, the blinders is that if the mind is made out of matter and energy, then that limits what the mind can do. And by mind, I mean both consciousness, conscious awareness, the unconscious, and aspects of perception and cognition and all the rest. So science today, at least from a set of assumptions, the worldview says that phenomena like clairvoyance and precognition and any kind of psychic phenomena, they cannot exist. It's impossible within the current worldview. But the scientific worldview is only about 300 to 400 years old. The previous worldview, which was held from the beginning of humanity, is sometimes called the esoteric worldview, and it is almost the complete opposite of today's scientific worldview. So whereas science is, a philosopher would say that it's the doctrine of materialism, everything is made out of matter and energy, the esoteric worldview had the opposite, where everything is made out of mind, including matter and energy. So from a philosopher would say that that's an idealistic viewpoint. And part of the goal of writing this book, Real Magic, was to review the esoteric traditions to show that for probably 20 to 50,000 years, up until the Enlightenment in the 16th and 17th century, it was assumed by most people in most places and times that ultimately the world is made up of consciousness. That's the underlying thread of the esoteric traditions. And within that tradition, suddenly concepts of magic are obvious, and psychic phenomena are obvious. It's easy to explain. So the magic I'm talking about includes three types of practices. The first is divination. Divination means perception through space and time. The practice would include things like use of tarot cards, tossing of dice, that sort of thing, mirror gazing. The second practice is sometimes called manifestation or force of will. This practice is the idea that your intentions can manipulate the world, can push it around a little bit. And the third practice is called theurgy, which is what people are doing when they're praying. They're praying typically for some kind of intercession on daily events or health or whatever the event may be from some higher power, or at least from some invisible power, often called spirits, for example. So those are the three practices of esoteric magic. And the idea about writing about this is that I'm not particularly philosophically minded. I'm interested in the stories as much as anyone else, but I'm primarily an empiricist. I like to test things. So for about 40 years now, most of my professional life has been involved in experimentally testing psychic phenomena in the laboratory. I'm one of about 50 people around the world who do this full-time. And this kind of work has gone on within science for about 150 years now. So when you look at the overall body of experiments that have been conducted and the overall results, it's very clear now, based on the evidence, that psychic phenomena exist. But what is not normally thought about is that something like telepathy or clairvoyance or precognition, usual vanilla type psychic experiences, when you compare the magical practices, for example, of divination, it turns out that that's exactly what we've been testing for the last century or so, but we've called it not magic, we call it clairvoyance, or we call it precognition. So what I'm able to show in the book is that it's some of the ancient esoteric magical ideas are true based on empirical data as collected by scientific methods. And what that allows us to do is to look back at the esoteric lore, not simply as superstition, but perhaps as a clue about how do we make the scientific worldview more comprehensive. The reason we need to make the scientific worldview more comprehensive is because it doesn't account for certain important things, primarily consciousness itself. So you look at the list of unexplained, very important aspects of reality that science has yet to understand, the nature of consciousness is right up there on the list, number one or number two on the various lists. And that's because we don't know how to explain subjective experience from the point of view of the operation of the brain or the operation of the brain and body. It just doesn't fit. Whereas in the esoteric traditions where consciousness is fundamental, well, then it fits perfectly well. So the nice thing about science is that it evolves. The reality that scientists knew in 1900 is extremely different than the one that we see in 2000, and it will be extremely different again in 2100. So we need to be humble in the face of what we don't know. And we sometimes get the illusion that we're smarter than we are, and we certainly have learned a few things, but there's an enormous amount left that we haven't even begun to study yet. And when you look at the leading edge of science today in several different disciplines, what you find is that rather than seeing reality as composed of matter and energy, which was popular throughout the 20th century, but in this century, the direction we seem to be going is that reality is made up of mathematics, or said a different way, it's made up of information, or it's made up of symbols. Well, these kinds of concepts are abstract. It's not, you know, you can't touch information very well, or symbols, and yet that's where the leading edge is in science today. When you compare that against the ideas of the esoteric traditions, you can see we're beginning to converge. So leading edge science is beginning to point yet again towards esoteric concepts in a direct way. Except that today, being scientific, we'll come up with mathematical models and new language, and we'll begin to understand what those ancient traditions were about in new ways. So, in a nutshell, that's what real magic is about.
One last question. And these ancients brought certain insights into their magical experiments that have been largely forgotten today in contemporary scientific research, which is largely, as you mentioned, reductionist. And these would include our faculties for attention, our motivation and intention, and the use of our will. And among the numerous experiments you have conducted in parapsychology has been measuring and validating the influence of our will upon the outer world, precognitive or intuitive experiences that would confirm our innate faculties of divination, and the third evidence to support the theurgy, which relates to near-death experiences or encounters with disembodied entities. And I'm mostly interested in the first two because they can best be related to promoting our health. So in a short period of time, the next 3 minutes, could you share some of the results of experiments you have conducted to support the paranormal attributes of our will and our abilities to divine or intuit events before they occur?
Well, in 3 minutes, it's difficult because we're talking about 100 years worth of data. But I suppose experiments looking at the effect of mind on matter have included everything from inanimate matter, things like electronic circuits and different kinds of materials, to a very wide range of animate matter, from bacteria to cell cultures to small animals to humans to plants, very broad range. And what we see across the board is that the act of focused attention with some intention, you need both, will cause a change in a living system. And of course, it may well be that part of the placebo effect, the expectation effects within the body, are actually a psychokinetic phenomenon. That we know that how you think about your own body and health has a pretty strong impact. What we don't know yet is exactly how that is happening. But given that we can see that if you direct your intention towards a cell culture, for example, that it will change the behavior of the cells, and that's not in your body, that's in a petri dish somewhere else, then it becomes at least plausible that the mind can do things directly and change aspects of the body, and that may be one of the underlying reasons why placebo effect works, not just in yourself, but in others as well.
Well said. I'm going to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour, where you have the time to lay out all these experiments over the last 100 years and give a more in-depth understanding of the paranormal. All right?
I'd be happy to.
We look forward to that conversation. Dr. Dean Radin, R-A-D-I-N, Chief Scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, Distinguished Associate Professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and he's taught at Princeton, University of Edinburgh, Stanford University's Research Institute for International Studies. So he'll be back, and his newest book is Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and the Guide to the Power of the Universe. His website is deanradin.org. And just a closing thought, just for real quick, before we sign off. Think of this. I believe that by accepting that there is a biological difference between men and women, other than just genitalia, that how we perceive reality is different and unique for each one. And how we relate to each other, how we relate to others, our ability to deal with the issues we face are uniquely different. That is what allows women to have that unique feminist perspective or female perspective and have uniquely male perspective. I believe all of us who are reasonable, responsible, and moral would abhor the idea that there should not be equal opportunity in all things. But that does not mean then by this artificial notion that we should all be equally interested in all things. If that were the case, then why is it that 99% of all sanitation work and cleaning up sewers is men? And so many of the things I could identify. And why are some things uniquely inspiring women? They don't have to do it. Men could do the same thing. Men could become nurses, and they don't. Not in the same percentage. And so if a woman is not as interested in physics or computers, but only at 20% of the same ratio in graduate schools and going on to master that, but their interest after getting a PhD is another discipline of science, that's partly because that's what interests them. They are aligning their unique perspective to that which they feel they can enjoy the most and make the greatest contribution, and they do. So there is no difference in the equality of opportunity, but there's a big difference in what we desire. And I believe it's extremely dangerous to weaponize the idea that all things must be 50-50, everything 50-50, when that takes away what would be the natural inclination of individuals. Opportunity, yes. No limitation, yes. But then trust that science of the mind and the natural intuitive ability of people also should be considered in the equation, and not politicized for some ideological gain. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.